Good evening. Please take your Bibles and turn to Job chapter 6. Job chapter 6. We'll be taking a look at chapters 6 and 7 tonight. This is in your lesson books. We are in lesson 5. And we looked at the first part of lesson 5 last week. And so tonight we are at the bottom of page 13. And so lesson five is covering Job 4, 5, 6, and 7. Last week we looked at chapters 4 and 5. You'll recall that Eliphaz's first speech is contained there in chapters 4 and 5. And then tonight, the second half, we're taking a look at Job's response to Eliphaz, which is found in Job chapters 6 and 7. So before we get into the text, let's go ahead and go to our God in prayer. Our Holy Father, we're thankful for another opportunity here in the middle of the week to come together with our spiritual family and to open up the pages of the book of Job, to take a look at his suffering, to take a look at his faith, take a look at the truths presented, take a look at your character and his character and the character of his friends and learn what we can, apply that to us, make sure we understand you and how you operate and how we are to respond to you and to the suffering that we experience in this life. We're thankful for the book of Job. We're thankful for your word, that we may learn these truths, that we may know more about you. We ask your blessings upon us as we study and upon all the classes and the teachers tonight, that each will gain some knowledge tonight that they will then be able to use in their daily life so they can be better servants in the kingdom. Thank you for Jesus and for his sacrifice, for his blood, for his resurrection, all of that which gives us the hope of our own forgiveness and resurrection, that we may all be together in heaven one day. It's in his name that we pray. Amen. Okay, so just a quick recap of chapters 4 and 5. Eliphaz's first speech. How would you summarize what his overall point was to Job? What did Eliphaz say about Job? He was a sinner. And because of that, then what? He's being punished by God for his sin. Okay, now that's pretty much the theme that's going to continue the entire book with Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar and all these friends of his, supposedly. They're going to be stating the same thing in different ways, and unfortunately they're going to get even harsher and harsher as they go along. But that was his response, or that was his speech. And so Job now responds to that in chapters 6 and 7. And so let's begin by taking a look at verses 1 through 13. And I'm going to be reading from the NIV, unlike my normal version, the New King James Version. The NIV is a little bit easier to understand when it comes to this Hebrew poetry, so I'm going to be reading from that. In Job chapter 6, it says, "Then Job replied, 'If only my anguish could be weighed and all my misery be placed on the scales, it would surely outweigh the sand of the seas. No wonder my words have been impetuous. The arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit drinks in their poison. God's terrors are marshaled against me. Does a wild donkey bray when it has grass, or an ox bellow when it has fodder? Is tasteless food eaten without salt, or is there flavor in the sap of the mallow? I refuse to touch it. Such food makes me ill. Oh, that I might have my request, that God would grant what I hope for, that God would be willing to crush me, to let loose his hand and cut off my life. Then I would still have this consolation, my joy in unrelenting pain, that I had not denied the words of the Holy One. What strength do I have that I should still hope? What prospects that I should be patient? Do I have the strength of stone? Is my flesh bronze? Do I have any power to help myself now that success has been driven from me?'" My first question tonight in the lesson material, there at the bottom of page 13, question number 11, is this: what is it that Job is saying first in his response here in these first 13 verses? What is it that he is desiring? Yeah, we're back to what he said back in chapter 3, right? That he is just wishing for death. He wants God to just go ahead and get it over with already. Cut me off. Finish me off. Take care of me here and now. Okay? So that's one part of what he says in verses 1 through 13. What else does he say about his life and what he's experiencing? Okay, he still maintains his integrity. He says at the end of that reading there in verse 13, in verse 10, that even if he has to suffer through this pain, at least at the end, I mean, if God would go ahead and cut him off and finish him off, then he would know that he had made it through without denying God, that he had been faithful to him and had not cursed God. And it seems to me that in this statement in verse 10, where he says that I would still have this consolation, my joy and unrelenting pain that I had not denied the words of the Holy One, he may be implying that if he lived longer, what might happen? He might turn against God. He might blaspheme God. And so it would actually be better for him to just go ahead and be done with this while he was still faithful to God. Because the worse it got, the longer it went on, the more it was prolonged, may be that what he's expressing here is that he's afraid of what he may say later on. Okay? What else does he say about his life in these first 13 verses? Yeah. The anguish is so heavy, weighing upon him, that it would outweigh the sands of the sea. It's just a burden that is unbearable. Okay, what else? What does he say God has done to him? I think I heard somebody say something. Look at verse 4. Using military language, what has God done to him? Shot arrows into him, marshaled his forces against him, and it's just, look, God's against me. He is attacking me, and I'm dying. And that's certainly the way he feels. Okay, take a look at verses 5 through 7, and let's see if we can figure out what he's talking about here as he's continuing to explain his anguish that he is in. He asks a series of rhetorical questions where the expected answer, for instance, in verse 5, does a wild donkey bray when it has grass or an ox bellow when it has fodder? When they have their food and are filled with their food, is the donkey going to be braying or is the ox lowing? Another way we may say it, another illustration today is a baby going to cry once he's gotten filled with his food? I mean, no, they're crying or the donkey braying or the oxen lowing because they're wanting food and then they get it and they are filled. But what about his food? Now, I've got all four translations pulled up here. I've got the New King James, ESV, New American Standard, and the NIV, and there are some differences in the way that this is translated. It is certainly up to debate exactly what is being referred to here in verse 6. The New King James speaks about any taste in the white of an egg. Y'all see that, those of you who have the New King James? And I agree with him on that one. Those of you who only eat egg whites, boy, you're missing out. Gotta have that yolk. But we're not sure what the word here actually means that is translated in the New King James, the white of an egg. But in the ESV, and the New American Standard also has white of an egg. In the ESV and the NIV, it talks about the sap or the juice of the mallow plant. This is not a marshmallow like what we eat, but it would have its origins, you know, in that. I don't know exactly what that looks like or tastes like, but His point there in verse 6 and 7, again, rhetorical questions in verse 6, can flavorless food be eaten without salt? Are you going to eat food that is tasteless and not add salt to it? Well, of course not. You're going to add salt to it. And then the sap of the mallow, is there flavor in the sap of the mallow? Apparently not. I don't know. I haven't tried it before. Okay, so obviously it's not a food that he would want to eat. And so he's contrasting the oxen and the donkey and their food and the fact that they're being filled with the dish that God is serving up to him. And what is his statement in verse 7? What does he feel about the dish that God is serving him? It makes him sick. He loathes it. He refuses to touch it. So in different ways, different metaphors, he is describing what God is doing to him and how he is in utter anguish. He doesn't have, or he's been shot through with arrows, and they're poisoned. And then, you know, the food that God is giving him is making him ill. So he doesn't have it too good, obviously. Right. Right. Exactly. In fact, the only thing he can be happy in is if God would grant his request, which is that he'd die, that he'd just go ahead and cut him off. Adam? Eliphaz, yeah. One thing is for sure. And that is, we think we know more than we really know. Even with the revelation that we've been given that Job didn't have, we still can be very guilty of thinking we know more than what we really know. And, you know, ascribing things to whatever. Best we can say is, maybe this is what's happening. Maybe this is what's happening. And look at it as a test of faith, you know, that obviously was the case for Job. But yeah, we don't know. Maybe one day we'll get all those answers, but you know what? It may be even in heaven that we're not given all the answers. I don't know. Will it matter at that point? No, we're not going to care. We're not going to care at that point. Okay, so verse 11, 12, and 13, with these questions, again, a series of rhetorical questions, that and the answer to these questions is, you have no strength, you have no hope in yourself. What strength do I have? What prospects I should be? You don't. You don't have any strength. You don't have any prospects. You don't have the strength of stone or the strength of flesh. I mean, he is helpless, is what he is saying. I can't do anything. I am at God's mercy. Okay. Any questions or comments on those verses? Any more insight that you want to share? Okay. Roger?
He's not expecting anything to get better either.
No.
What is my end that I should if I got anything to look forward to.
Exactly. Yeah, no, there's nothing for him to look forward to in his mind. Yeah. He doesn't see an end in sight. He doesn't know what we know, that it was only going to last a short period of time, even though we don't know exactly how long it lasted. James? Were you? Oh, okay. I'm sure you're not offended, though, if I call you Jim, right? I'm sure you're not offended if I call you Jim, though. Okay, so let's pick up in verse 14, and we're going to read through verse 30. Anyone who withholds kindness from a friend forsakes the fear of the Almighty. But my brothers are as undependable as intermittent streams, as the streams that overflow when darkened by thawing ice and swollen with melting snow, but that stop flowing in the dry season and in the heat vanish from their channels. Caravans turn aside from their routes. They go off into the wasteland and perish. The caravans of Tema look for water. The traveling merchants of Sheba look in hope. They are distressed because they have been confident. They arrive there only to be disappointed. Now you too have proved to be of no help. You see something dreadful and are afraid. Have I ever said, give something on my behalf? Pay a ransom for me from your wealth? Deliver me from the hand of the enemy? Rescue me from the clutches of the ruthless? Teach me and I will be quiet. Show me where I have been wrong. How painful are honest words, but what do your arguments prove? Do you mean to correct what I say and treat my desperate words as wind? You would even cast lots for the fatherless and barter away your friend. But now be so kind as to look at me. Would I lie to your face? Relent. Do not be unjust. Reconsider, for my integrity is at stake. Is there any wickedness on my lips? Can my mouth not discern malice? Okay, so this question that we're asking that covers these verses is, what is Job saying about his friends here in verses 14 through 30? Have they been helpful at all? No help for Job, certainly not from his friends. And look at verse 14. Anyone who withholds kindness from a friend, that part of the translation is sure. Pretty much everybody agrees on how that should be translated. He's referring to the fact that his friends should be giving him kindness, mercy, loyalty, but they're not giving him that. Now, the rest of the verse, they're not sure about the order of the words and who the who it's referring to. The NIV says, anyone who withholds kindness from a friend forsakes the fear of the Almighty. So it's the friend that's withholding the kindness that is in the wrong and is forsaking the Almighty. The New King James, on the other hand, says, to him who is afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friend, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. So it's the friend that's afflicted, according to the New King James translation, that is forsaking the fear of the Almighty, instead of the friend that should be offering the help that's forsaking the fear of the Almighty. We don't know which is correct, as is evidenced by the different translations, but I think the overall point is obvious, is that Job expected more from his friends than what he was getting. He was not getting the mercy. He was not getting the kindness. He was not getting the loyalty that he thought that he should receive from his friends. Let me just take the position of the New King James for just a moment. And let's say that there is someone that we are friends with, and someone, maybe even a Christian, who is going through some extremely difficult times. And maybe it's even because of their own fault, because of their own sin, because they have forsaken the fear of the Almighty. What is Job saying is the way that we should treat that person? Still show him kindness. Does it do any good to Job or to anybody else who is would be in the situation. Well, now we know Job hadn't sinned, but just taking that assumption of his friends that he had, what good did it do them to come in and rake him over the coals? And pile on him, yeah.
Jesus put it better than it could ever be put by anyone else, but him who is without sin cast the first stone. Yeah. Yeah. So if you're going to start throwing rocks, you better make sure your life is in order.
That's right.
And that is a false premise to begin with, because which of us would dare stand in front of each other or God Almighty and say, I got my life in order? That's scary.
Yeah.
Think that way.
Now, he is not saying, and I don't think the scriptures say, that if the person is forsaking the fear of the Almighty, that he is sinning before God and he doesn't have his life right, that gives us any right to come in and just be harsh with him. But the reverse is also true, and I know this is not what David's saying, is that just because we aren't 100% correct in everything, just because we have sinned also in our lives, doesn't relieve us of the responsibility to go to that friend and try to get them to correct their life. It's the way in which it was being done that was the problem. It was the accusations that was being made. It was the not knowing the full situation. And it was the high-mindedness and the arrogance and the self-righteousness that was an issue. And so the way we approach these situations, you know, if the New King James way of saying it is what is intended by the author of Job, that application, that principle is still certainly true, Dave.
It's also where Jesus said, judge not that you be not judged. That standard that you use for judgment is going to be used for
right.
you. I heard somebody say, we don't judge people to hell. We try to judge people to heaven. If we're going to pass judgment on somebody, and there are times when we should, it should be a judgment that will encourage them toward heaven, toward truth, toward righteousness,
right.
Not toward condemnation. It's just like Jesus told the lady, you know, I don't condemn you. Why? She was already condemned. She knew that she was guilty of the sin.
Right.
There was no point in him pointing that out again. Once again, you know, you're a low-life adulteress.
And then the very next statement was, go and sin no more.
Sin
so
no more.
Correct it, move on. Yeah. And if we take the NIV's wording, which is anyone who withholds kindness from a friend forsakes the fear of the Almighty, is there truth in that rendering of the verse as well? Yeah, I believe so. I believe that's a true statement, that if you're not going to be a friend to a person who is suffering and is in need, not saying you withhold correction when correction is needed, but if you withhold kindness, can you correct and be kind at the same time? Well, you better be. That's the way we're supposed to be. And if you're not, then you're forsaking the fear of the Almighty. You're not doing it the way God wants you to do. Is that a true hand this time for a comment? Okay, James. Right, I said James. Right.
It depends on if you know, you can see, and it's obvious what you're doing, you may be harsh on them. But Job's friend come in, and they don't know what's going on.
Right.
But they're coming in and being very harsh.
Yeah.
But they have nothing to be harsh about because they don't know anything.
Yeah. Yeah, there are times that we will know the situation and that we will know that, okay, you have certainly brought this upon yourself. And there's a direct cause and effect relationship going on here. And you're in danger right now. We need to get you out of this now. And you better turn your life around or else you're going to die physically and spiritually. You know, so, in those cases, like James was talking about, we have to be maybe a little bit more harsh. We have to yank him out of the fire quickly. But then other situations we're more gentle with. But as James said, his friends didn't know the situation. They make a lot of assumptions. And later on in the book, while initially they are very vague and general in their statements about Job, you sinned, they start accusing him of some very specific sins, horrific crimes. And I'm like, really? And you've been watching me this whole time and you know that I've done this? How can you say that? They did not know the situation and they were being harsh unnecessarily so. So, back to our question, what does Job say about his friends? First of all, he's saying you're withholding kindness. And then in verses 15 through, going down through verse 20 and the first part of verse 21, what illustration does he use to make the point about how his friends are undependable? What natural phenomenon? Okay. Over there in that country, in that region, as well as in the American Southwest, this is very common, where the type of climate, type of soil and so forth leads to this, where you can have some heavy rains and it presents what we call flash floods, where it could be dry in these gullies, in these wadis. They're called wadis over there, in these dry creek beds, dry stream beds, river beds, whatever. And the only time that water is in them is after a heavy rain, and they don't last very long at all. This might be what we refer to as a gully washer. Okay, it's just washing out the gullies. And just almost as quickly as it's come, it's going to go away as well. And so he says, you're just like those streams where they're undependable. The caravans, they come along and they're looking for water and they're following the stream and hoping to find water, and they go out there in the wilderness and they perish because nothing can be found. They thought there would be water out there, but it's not there. And you are just like that water, or those wadis, rather. Undependable. You do not provide any kind of benefit. There is hope that there will be some relief, but it's not to be found. Verse 21 says, now you too have proved to be of no help, just like these dry riverbeds. You're dry. You're not offering me anything. So the point is that his friends should have been a source of comfort to him, but they were anything but, and they were unreliable. The verse that talks in verse 16 about the stream bed being dark because of the ice and the melted snow, I think it's just referring to the water being in the, coming off, running off the mountains or whatever, down into the bed and becoming dark with water, but then dissipating very quickly. By the way, just a little geography note here. It mentions Tema and Sheba. Tema was one of the sons of Ishmael, and the region of Tema was located in Edom, up in the northwestern portion of the Sinai Peninsula. So this would be south of modern-day Jordan, and so up in the northwestern section of that peninsula. And then Sheba is located at the southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula, modern-day Yemen. So I'll let y'all get out your maps later on if you want to and take a look at where that is. But he's talking about these caravans that are coming from these different places looking for water along the route, and they find these streams and there's nothing there, and that's exactly like his friends were. They were like those streams. They were nothing. Questions or comments? Okay, take a look at verse 22 and 23. What is his point here when he asks them, Have I ever asked anything from you? Have I ever asked for money from you? Have I ever asked for your help and trying to rescue me from the dangers or from enemies or anything? Yeah. Right. He is not asking for anything of a physical nature. He's not asking for money. He's not asking for... He just wants their help, their loyalty, their sympathy, and nothing more like a friend should offer, and they are not giving it to him. So verses 24 through 30, through the end of the chapter, he says, show me where I'm wrong. You got something to say? Okay, well, you got to be a little bit more specific here. You got to prove it to me. Prove where I am wrong in this. Verse 26, we're going to see this phrase multiple times in Job as we go along. Verse 26, he says, do you mean to correct what I say and treat my desperate words as wind? All the translations speak of the words being as wind. We would say somebody is full of hot air, or I don't know how many times you've called somebody a windbag, but you know, your words are empty. And Roger, are you calling your wife a windbag? I mean, you looked at her as soon as I said that, right? So he's saying, even if my words are empty and full of wind, then what good is it doing you to correct them? He feels so strongly about how his friends are treating him and how heartless they are that he says, you would even do what? What are two things that he says you would even do this? In verses 27, or in verse 27. Cast lots for an orphan. I mean, how heartless can you be that you would try to take possession of an orphan and you're casting lots for an orphan, or barter away your friend, just trying to find some advantage here? And he says, that's what you're making me feel like. So he then ends this section in verses 28 through 30 with a plea. He's been quite harsh on his friends. Now he kind of backs off a little bit and begs them to take a look at him, and what does he insist that he is not doing? Yeah, he says, I promise to you, I am not lying here. Look at me. Why would I lie to you? What good would it do me? So he emphatically states that he would never lie to them and implores them to stop accusing him of sin. He is not sinning. Good point.
The expression, kicked him when he's down.
Yeah. That's exactly what they were doing. They were kicking him when he was down. Let's move on to chapter 7 as he continues his response to Eliphaz. All right, chapter 7, verse 1. Do not mortals have hard service on earth? Are not their days like those of hired laborers, like a slave longing for the evening shadows, or a hired laborer waiting to be paid? So I have been allotted months of futility, and nights of misery have been assigned to me. When I lie down, I think, how long before I get up? The night drags on, and I toss and turn until dawn. My body is clothed with worms and scabs. My skin is broken and festering. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle, and they come to an end without hope. So, question number 13 in our material on page 14 is just to describe Job's lament here in these first six verses. What is it he is enduring? So, what are some of the descriptions that he gives here? What does he say first about the days? What is allotted man, and then how does that contrast to him? What does he say about man in general and what his life is like? Long, weary days, hard service on the earth. And of course, that all goes back to the curse, does it not, in Genesis 3 in the garden? And he illustrates it with the, he says, are not their days like those of hired laborers? There's a slave who longs for the evening shadows. The NIV says, the other translations speak about a shade. You know, if you're out there in the hot sun working, you're looking forward to finding some shade, some respite from that heat. And if you're a day laborer, what are you looking forward to? What does he say that he is looking forward to at the end of the day? Being paid, his wages. But what about Job? Does he have any hope of respite, like shade for the slave in the sun or wages at the end of the day? Does he have any hope of that? What's allotted to him? Nothing except what? Misery, futility, months of futility. I think it was Linda Lyle a few classes ago that asked, do we know how long these events of Job took place? The answer is no to that, but this might be a clue that it was not a short period of time. I mean, it wasn't just a few days, obviously, but at least a few months. Maybe shorter than a year. Maybe he would have said years if it had been longer than just a few months. I don't know for sure, but you know, this has been going on for some time, or at least it appears to him that it's going to be this way. So I've been allotted months of futility, and what's the night like for him? Can't sleep. Any of you ever have trouble with insomnia? Okay? Any of you have trouble with insomnia and pain at night, that pain is keeping you awake? Okay? Neuropathy? Okay, Danny, didn't you tell me just recently about your knee keeping you up at night? Daytimes was better than nighttime because of the pain. Okay, now multiply that times 10. And the nighttime is when you're supposed to receive relief, right? From the day's work, not for him. Now, the daytime, it may seem strange that he's saying that the daytime is passing quickly when he just said that the nighttime is dragging on and on and on. But look at the context, and I think you'll understand what he's saying here. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle, and they come to an end without hope. Well, it might help us to know what a weaver's shuttle is. Anybody in here ever use a loom before? Anybody ever seen a loom? Okay. Where you take the wool and you're weaving on the loom and making some type of garment or rug or whatever. I didn't know what a weaver's shuttle was, so I looked it up. And here are a couple of pictures from Wikipedia. This wooden tool is the shuttle. And this right here, this inside of the shuttle, is a bobbin, I think is the correct term. Maybe y'all are familiar with what that is. Y'all can go home and look this up later if you want to. But the bobbin and then the thread, in this case red, is on the bobbin. And what the shuttle does, well, I'll just read to you what I copied from Wikipedia. A weaver's shuttle is a tool designed to neatly and compactly store a holder, the bobbin, that carries the thread of the weft yarn while weaving with a loom. Shuttles are thrown or passed back and forth through the shed between the yarn threads of the warp in order to weave in the weft. I know that made perfect sense to everybody in here. What's happening is they are taking, here's the shuttle right here, and you can see how it's threaded through there, And it is somehow, not that it's done automatically these days, but it would have been tossed back and forth through the different yarns to, I guess, wrap around and make the weave and all that kind of stuff. Apparently, Roger knows all about it, so he's going to... One's going one direction, one's going the other, right, yeah.
It goes up, and then one goes down, and then it reverses itself, and between each one, there was paddles on each end that hit that thing real loud, real hard. That's what those metal ends were for, and it would knock it. You couldn't see it. It would go like a bullet, and it would catch on the other one. Mm-hmm. And then it would move down, and it would hit it back the other way. So this was just weaving, and it was going pretty fast. But that's, I thought, that is really a good example of how fast life is, because
right.
You can't see that.
And that's his point, is just as quickly as a weaver will throw this shuttle through in the process and the yarn is spinning and quickly coming to an end, that's what his life feels like. And he can see the thread running out. That's what he's saying about the days are passing swiftly. They may drag on in one sense, but in another sense he's saying, you know, it's just days are passing, nothing's getting better, I just see nothing except dead end here. And it's just coming quickly. Okay. What is Job's complaint to God? This is in verses 7 through 21. So let's quickly read it. Verse 7. Remember, O God, that my life is but a breath. My eyes will never see happiness again. The eye that now sees me will see me no longer. You will look for me, but I will be no more. As a cloud vanishes and is gone, so one who goes down to the grave does not return. He will never come to his house again. His place will know him no more. Therefore, I will not keep silent. I will speak out in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I the sea or the monster of the deep that you put me under guard? When I think my bed will comfort me and my couch will ease my complaint, even then you frighten me with dreams and terrify me with visions, so that I prefer strangling in death rather than this body of mine. I despise my life. I would not live forever. Let me alone. My days have no meaning. What is mankind that you make so much of them, that you give them so much attention, that you examine them every morning and test them every moment? Will you never look away from me or let me alone even for an instant? If I have sinned, what have I done to you, you who see everything we do? Why have you made me your target? Have I become a burden to you? Why do you not pardon my offenses and forgive my sins? For I will soon lie down in the dust. You will search for me, but I will be no more. So ultimately, what is his complaint to God here? How would you sum that up?
He's being punished and he doesn't know why.
Okay, he's being punished and he doesn't know why. And what does he want God to do? Leave me alone. You know, he's already stated it one way of just go ahead and get over with, you know, cut off my life right now. But now he focuses on this aspect of just, your eye is on me all the time. You're constantly on me. Get off my back, God, please. Leave me alone. So his complaint is he's got a brief life. He's in a lot of anguish, and in verse 12, he says, am I the sea or the monster of the deep that you put me under guard? Am I like the unruly sea or the sea creatures, these sea monsters? We're going to talk about Leviathan and Behemoth and so forth later on, that you have to keep me in check? And the answer to that, of course, is no, I'm not like that, God, so why are you doing this? And then at nighttime, what is he receiving from God? Bad dreams. He's terrified at night. And so he says, I'd rather just die. My days have no meaning. Leave me alone, please, Dave.
Saying, there's somebody attacking me, God, help me out. You know, he doesn't see the discussion.
Right.
Or the even the possibility of the discussion between God and Satan.
Yeah.
And which, you know, I always look at, you see some commentaries or some scholars that will question the existence of hell, question the existence of the devil. Is it real? Or is it just something that's used to help us understand the absence of God? And you know, really, kind of like Job, I don't care whether the devil is real. I don't really care whether hell is real. I just know that it's not with God. It's outside of God's grace. It's outside of God's mercy. So beyond that, who cares what it is? It's the most horrible thing that there could be.
Right.
But Job doesn't seem, so far, he doesn't seem to consider.
Yeah, he never even talks about Satan in the book. It's all God, and he knows that God is the only one he can turn to, is the only one that can do something about his situation. And so he's always complaining to God about this and bring his suit to God. Take a look at Job 7, verse 17 in particular. And there's the question I asked there on number 15 in your lesson book. Job 7, 17 sounds similar to Psalm 8 and verse 4. So verse 17 says in the NIV, what is mankind? Well, you know what? I'm going to read it from the New King James. What is man that you should exalt him, that you should set your heart on him? And then verse 18, that you should visit him every morning and test him every moment. Go over to Psalm 8. You know this verse, and it's quoted in the New Testament as well by the Hebrew writer. But Psalm 8 and verse 4, David says, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? Okay, now in Job's context, what is his point as we, the question I want to ask is, compare and contrast Job 7:17 to Psalm 8:4. What is Job's point about God visiting man and paying attention to man? Is it good or bad? It's bad. In this context, he doesn't want God to pay attention to him. He doesn't want God to always be on him and, you know, doing stuff with him. He wants him to leave him alone. David, though, in Psalm 8, what's that context? Is man mindful? He's mindful of man and visiting man. Is it good or is it bad? It's good. In fact, back at verse 3, you see the context is, when I consider the universe, the cosmos, and I think how insignificant man is, it is amazing to me that you promote man to this position of being just a little bit lower than the angels. Okay, so similar language, and I wonder if David had Job 7:17 in mind and then just turned it to a different perspective. But in any case, Job is saying, you're making much to do about me, and I want you to leave me alone, please. Or at least answer what it is that I've done wrong. Show me what I've done. Why aren't you forgiving me and letting me have some relief? Please, God, help me out here. Right. It might be similar to asking, isn't there somebody else you can go bother for a while? You're focusing so much on me. Okay.
Is he saying here, is he talking about bothering when he says, what is man that you should exalt him, that you should set? In other words, I'm so low, why do I deserve you to exalt me, that you should set your heart on me and visit me?
Yeah. Yeah, no, but he's exalting him in the sense that he's focusing his attention on him. And I think in that greater context, it's all about, you're wearing me out, God. You continue to hound me and so forth, and so you singled me out. You've picked me out, and please leave me alone. Okay, Brent is teaching next class, do the next lesson, which is chapters 8 through 10, and that's lesson 6 in your book. Thank you.